primitives here, has been on the idea of properties changing and objects changing. And one of the things that sort of started emerging, especially in conversations between Alexandre Guillot and Olivier Sardiner, was the issue of, can you make sense of the fundamental laws of the universe changing? And there's previous literature out there claiming that they can't. And one of the, I think, central obstacles to arguing that the laws of the universe can change is dispositional essentialism. Now, dispositional essentialism does not directly challenge that view, because what dispositional essentialism is claiming is that fundamental laws of the universe are metaphysically necessary. Right? There's not just the concept of nomological necessity involved, but it is impossible in the strongest sense that the laws of nature are invariant. Now, that doesn't itself say anything about cross-temporal changes, right? Just arguing that trans-world changes are not possible. But if you get rid of the metaphysical necessity that comes along with dispositional essentialism, then that does clear, in a way that I'll say something briefly about at the end, at least a path to allow diachronic changes in laws. Now, there's a number of different developments of dispositional essentialism. As a sort of background, I'm taking Alexander Bird's version of it as a takeoff point, and of course, you know, there are various ways of developing this, but that's a backdrop. No disservice to other versions of this, but I had to take something as a target, and that was the one that I chose. All right. Another caveat, I'm only talking about ontological emergence. I said that it's a heterogeneous concept. Not interested here in epistemological emergence or conceptual emergence, just ontological emergence. And I'm interested in that because I think that's the hardest kind of emergence to defend. And if you can do that, then the other versions, I think, come along fairly naturally. Now, there's going to be a lot of ground clearing here. And I'm not in any obvious sense a metaphysician, right? As you probably know, I'm not really a big fan of certain kinds of metaphysics. If you do it in a scientifically sensitive way, that's fine. But I need to give you various preliminary definitions, and this is not always the most interesting thing, but they're necessary because otherwise we don't know what we're talking about. So here's what dispositional essentialism is, and that's the first definition in part B on the handout. Let me just read this. So dispositional essentialism is a position that there are no worlds in which the dispositional property involved and its stimulus both exist, and co-occurrences of instances of them are not accompanied by an instance of the manifestation property. So what's it claimed to be impossible is, go to a world, you've got the dispositional property and its relevant stimulus conditions, and you will never find the absence of the manifestation property. Now, what the connection is between disposition and the manifestations, again, I want to be as general as possible. I'm going to leave open. Maybe it's causal, maybe it's not. Absent objections, I think that's a reasonably general position to take. All right, now, I hope you can see that dispositional essentialism is a barrier to laws changing, right? Because if laws are things that are tightly connected with dispositions, and that's what I'm going to take here. There's a paper that is circulating that's jointly authored by me and Alexandre Guillot and Olivier Sartner, in which three primary accounts of laws are canvassed, that considerations as to whether they're allowed or not. The bit that I wrote was about the dispositional approach, and so that's the one that is considered here. If you're a fan of other accounts of laws, well, go and talk to Olivier or Alexandra and they'll tell you what the possibilities are there. All right. Okay, so what I'm going to argue is that the essentialist bit of dispositionalism is not required, and that the undoubtedly powerful and interesting arguments have been given in favor of that can be resisted, at least in certain cases. I think actually the majority of cases, and as we'll see as we go through the talk, I do think that dispositional essentialism is true of certain fundamental dispositions. And probably the laws that relate those dispositional properties are metaphysically necessary in the way that traditional dispositional essentialism has argued. But not all, and probably, I think, not most of them. Right? So we'll get those arguments as they come along. Right, now, that claim that disposition essentialism in its general form is false is a sort of blunt claim. So immediately let me modify it a little bit so that metaphysicians out there don't think I'm just ignoring certain possibilities. So one of the things I'm going to do is set aside concerns about finks, antidotes, and Severus Paribus laws, right? Those are all important issues, but they're not central to the issues that I'm concerned here today, and they were just sort of muddy things in a way that is probably not here centrally important. All right, I'm going to restrict dispositions to deterministic cases. If you immediately think, well, that's unduly restrictive, then I'll just take the standard line that what's determined as the probability distribution, and then after that it's just chances. So that covers most of the territory here. Now, next qualification, I'm going to be concerned just with fundamental properties. Now, caveat, that does not mean that all of those properties are properties of fundamental physics. Right? We're talking about emergence here. We ought to allow with ontological emergence that there are fundamental properties that lie outside not just the realm of fundamental physics, but physics in general. So I believe or argue that there are emergent properties in chemistry, and so please keep that distinction in mind. All right. So what motivates taking dispositional essentialism as the most appropriate account of laws? Well, what motivates that for me is something that I call the origin of the universe problem. And the origin of the universe problem is very simple. How did the universe know what to do at the very first point in time? Right? So we're not dealing with cyclical universes here, but something in which the universe actually got going dynamically at some particular point in time. Now, that metaphorical sense, how did it know what to do, is important, because we don't want, or at least I don't want, a governing law conception of laws. And that seems to me very hard to make sense of. Here are the laws kind of standing in the wings, waiting to be called on, get into action to motivate where the universe goes next. That's a situation I find not a very appealing one. What are the alternatives? Well, if you're a regularity theorist about laws, okay, you have to kind of wait for a bit to know what the universe is going to do before you can then say, all right, okay, now we've got a regularity. Now we know what the laws are. That's not going to be possible if you have a dynamic effect development. On a best systems version of a regularity account, right? It's even worse. You have to wait until the end of the universe when everything is in, and then you retrospectively go back and say, oh, yeah, okay, there are the patterns. This is the best one. Those are the what the laws are. That's no help to the universe. The universe needs to know what to do at the beginning. And so faced with that problem, I think a natural approach to take to solving the origin of the universe problem is to take the idea that at that first point there were properties, these properties are dispositional, and in some sense, and I'll say more about this in a minute, in some sense, everything you need to do to, you know, move to the next stage, and here's the next caveat, I'm going to talk about discrete time. I think it's reasonably easy to generalize to continuous time, but for simplicity, we'll take discrete time. What you need to know, or the universe needs to know in order to get to the next step, is right there in the dispositions at the first point in time. All right. Okay, so that's the problem. Well, we need some ontology to generate a solution. And here is where the sequence of definitions comes in. And probably some of you are going to think maybe these are the best definitions, and we can talk about that in the Q&A. All right, so definition two in part B is definition of fundamental object. Fundamental object is an object that is non-composite. Now, why have I taken that? Well, because, you know, being in some sense generically a naturalist, that's what the standard model of physics takes to be a fundamental object. Right? If you look at why an electron is taken to be a fundamental object, well, it's point-like, therefore no components, therefore it's fundamental. Right? So what I'm not doing is saying that something is fundamental if it's governed by fundamental laws, for example. So that's the account of what a fundamental object is. And once you've got that, then a fundamental property is the property of a fundamental object. So step two in definition three. And then you get property of definition of what is a dispositional property. And let me read this one out. So a property V is dispositional, just in case D would manifest characteristic properties when characteristic stimulus properties are present, and D is also present, and this is a bit that makes it dispositional, at times when those stimulus conditions are absent. So I hope that's, you know, echoes reasonably familiar account of what dispositional property actually is. All right. Now, further caveat. There's a standard contrast in the literature in this area between dispositional properties and categorical properties. I find for this particular project that contrast not to be terribly helpful. In part because I think fundamental laws are likely to contain a mixture of what metaphysicians have taken to be dispositional and categorical properties. Those of you who are not familiar with that distinction, here's the account that Alexander Bird has given, which says that fundamental categorical properties are those whose natures are picked out by quiddities. Quiddities are the sort of property version of exeities, that is, you know, the identity of that particular property, which is given generally non-descriptively. That's what gives you the identity conditions for categorical properties across worlds. And also, there are no necessary conditions on that categorical view with other entities. Right? So dispositional essentialism generally is associated with something that says that the properties are not categorical. But I don't want to rely on that distinction. It's not particularly helpful for this project. So you can find that worth exploring in other contexts, but not necessarily here. All right. So what are these definitions got to do with laws? Well, here's what my definition of a fundamental law is, and I want to draw a distinction between law-like regularities and laws. Law-like regularities are the patterns of events that you find when you've got the instantiations of the stimulus conditions, the dispositional property, and the manifestation. Right? But a fundamental law is what's given in definition five God. See? So a fundamental law has got the generic form of relation between fundamental properties. Now, one thing you'll immediately notice here is that I'm not appealing to the conditional account of laws, and that's deliberate. Now, the dispositional properties, of course, are going to have subjunctive features built into them. But the reason why we stay away from a conditional analysis is that that inevitably sucks you into the semantics of conditionals. Once you get there, it's hard to argue people away from the view that some possible world semantics is what you're going to have to deal with. And the one thing I do not want to do is to be committed to a possible world analysis of conditionals. I think in terms of the necessitations that are involved here, that is very much the wrong way to do things. Because what we're dealing with here is the kind of necessitation that is involved with diachronic developments of laws. So what the focus ought to be on is what kind of necessitation is going on within our world, right? And can you break that and show that that necessitation doesn't commit you to the laws of nature remaining the same, even though they are actually in a deterministic world, giving you a highly predictable kind of outcome within the domain of application. I'm not interested in analyzing necessities in terms of seeing what other possible worlds the particular regularities hold. If that raises hackles, fine, I understand. And again, we can sort of talk about that. All right. So we've got a relation between fundamental properties. You already know what fundamental properties are. R is a generic, abstract here, relation. It could be a causal relation. It could be a second-order relation between properties. At this point, I think it covers any and all of those. Right? So that's what a fundamental is in the analysis. Important distinction now, there are qualitative laws and there are quantitative laws. Right? Many of the laws in which we're interested in, especially in fundamental physical sciences, are quantitative. And so when we're going to refine this account here, the relation and the properties themselves, we're going to be focusing on the quantitative part. And to do that, if you go to the second part of the definition here, in the qualitative part, S is simply a stimulus condition, P is a dispositional property, and M is a manifestation. But in the quantitative case, I think this is better represented by a function between a particular instance of a quantitative stimulus condition and an instantiation of quantitative disposition. That functional relation gives you a unique value of an instantiation of quantitative manifestation. Now, again, that's fairly abstract. We'll have some examples in a moment, but that's the case that I'm going to be focusing on. Right. Now, before we get to the example in D, I've got two further assumptions. Tell you as we go along why I need this. So the first one is something that will be familiar to you from Armstrong. Maybe Aristotle held this. I don't know. I'm not an expert. You know, it's a recognizable view. And that is that these dispositional properties are wholly and completely located at each of their instances. Now, the reason why I need that is because of the origin of the universe problem, right? The property cannot be distributed over later instances of the disposition, let alone instances in other possible worlds. In order to drive the dynamic development of the universe, at that very first instance, it's got to be wholly and completely there. So that's the reason why I think assumption one is in fact forced on me. The second assumption, two, is again something that is fairly common, although widely disagreed with, and that's the assumption of immanent properties. And so assumption two, indeed, is that properties, including dispositional properties, don't exist until their first instance. Now, again, just hold off a minute and you'll see why I think I have to be committed to that. It's in part because these dispositional properties are going to ultimately be succeeded by other dispositional properties. But if you don't have assumption two, you inexorably get drawn into the position that all of those other dispositional properties have to be sort of bundled together in the initial disposition so that everything that the universe ever needs is somehow contained in one giant disposition at the beginning. So that is, well, that's too much. Right? It's something that I think one really does not need. What are we doing? Another disposition. The first property need not have the disposition to bring about the manifestation of the second dispositional property. So this disposition could be a disposition to bring about another disposition which has characteristic manifestation problems, but it does not mean that the original disposition has the disposition to bring about those future manifestations. Here's an example. Portland cement is a common building material. When you buy it, it's a powder. When you mix it with water, it turns into mortar, and it takes on characteristically different properties. Now, we're not deciding here whether, you know, Portland cement plus water provides an emergent property. That's not the issue here. The issue is with the dispositions treated at the everyday level. So at T, Portland cement has the disposition, when it's mixed with water, to, at T prime, become mortar. And then at some further point, T double prime, that mortar is going to harden, and it will have the manifestation of resisting indentations from your thumb. Right? So, everyday example. Okay? It's not true that a T, the Portland cement, has the disposition right then at T to produce the manifestation of resisting indentation of your thumb. You've got a pile of Portland cement there, and you stick your thumb into it, it's going to be an indentation, right? So I hope you got the general idea here, right? These dispositions are characteristically diachronic. They have to first produce an intermediate dispositional property, which then, with its own characteristics in those conditions, produces a new kind of manifestation, which was not possible back at the original point of the original disposition. So that's why I think we don't need to build all of the future dispositions of the universe into what's going on at the initial point. So I think that's an important feature. All right, okay. So here's now what I've been working up to, which is the central argument against dispositional essentialism. So the principal argument for dispositional essentialism, at least in many of the papers that I'm familiar with, is the idea that the relation between disposition and its manifestations is metaphysically necessary. And what that means in the account of laws that I've given you there, that the relation between those properties P1 through PN, that relation is metaphysically necessary. Right? That's how it's captured in the version that I have. And so with respect to fundamental properties, properties are individuated, and the arguments for dispositional essentialism are very, very tightly connected to identity conditions of properties. So if you believe that the identities for dispositions are actually hashed out in terms of, and let's think about the causal case, how they causally manifest themselves given the stimulus conditions, then the argument from dispositional essentialism is that if you went to another possible world, you find the disposition is there, it's also got the relevant stimulus conditions, but the manifestation conditions are absent. That means that this actually cannot be a case of the disposition that you thought it was. Now, there's much more sophisticated arguments than that, but that's the kind of basic idea of dispositional essentialism. And it makes sense in the canonical cases that people tend to discuss. So if you consider the fundamental dispositional property of being negatively charged, right, things that electrons have, if you came across what was supposed to be an instance of a negative charge, and you took that instance and put it some proximity to another negative charge, and you found that they did not repel one another, that would be a conclusive reason on dispositional essentialism to deny that object that you started out with actually had the property of being negatively charged. Right? And it's not just an intuition or a philosophical view. That seems to be the right reaction that a scientist should have if they came across something that was claimed to be a negative charge and it did not exhibit that characteristic behavior. Okay? Similarly, you've got something that's claimed to be a negative charge, you put it in proximity to a positive charge, and the two things did not track one another, then you haven't got a negative charge at the beginning. Right? That argument, I think, is an ontological argument. It's not an argument about the stipulative use of the predicate negatively charged, but it's a feature of negative charge itself, which is why it's, to me, a very interesting argument. Now, let's suppose that we can agree that positive charges repel other positive charges is a metaphysically necessary qualitative law. Right? I'm willing to grant that, which is why I said at the beginning that I think dispositional essentialism is in fact correct in a certain number of cases. But qualitative laws are not the only thing. So let's have a look at a case of a quantitative law. And now, for clarity, I'm going to give you a hypothetical example. Okay? Generally speaking, I like real examples, but I think to keep things clear here, I'm going to give you a hypothetical argument. All right. So here's the argument in part F of the paper. And let's walk through this. So let's consider some world. Right? Now, I said, I'm not a big fan of other possible worlds, but this is a hypothetical example. So this is the scenario. You've got a world in which Hooke's law, unlike our own worlds, is a fundamental law. Right? That's just one of the things that governs fundamental entities, right, and fundamental properties. The fundamental entities in this world take three kinds. One is wires, right? So please bear with me, right? Wires are not composite objects in W, right? They're not made up of molecular structure. They're just a fundamental object, right? You kind of scan them with whatever instrument you've got, just a wire, continuous, elongated object. There's also spatial extension and also forces. Right. Okay. Now, why have I taken wires to be non-composite entities that are fundamental? Here's a crucial point. You can identify wires, right, in terms of features that are not connected. They're independent of the way the wires behave, right? So here's the thing. Is it elongated? Yes. Is it metal? Yes. Then, pretty good sense that you've got a wire. We don't go around, for example, testing to see whether something is going to obey Hooke's law when an electrician is installing wires in the wall here, right? That's a wire, right? You don't need to look at its characteristic manifestations with respect to Hooke's law. All right. Now, what's the law-like claim here? Here, we've got Hooke's law, and the claim is that wires produce a restoring force when they're extended. Now, those components of that law are things that you can test by observation. Right? You can measure the restoring force, and you can tell when the wire is being extended. So, got a wire, hang up a weight on it, extends it a little bit, the wire produces a restoring force. Okay, that's not a conceptual truth. It's a contingent factor matter. It's not only easy to conceive, I hope, that Hooke's law might not be true quantitatively. I hope it's easy to conceive that it's not even hard to conceive that it could be false qualitatively. Wires might contract when you hang a weight on them, right? So I hope that this simple example is something that draws you very strongly towards the idea that there are a number of different possibilities here, right? Genuine physical possibilities for how Hooke's law might behave in a given possible world. Now, in W, the world that I've been considering, Hooke's law is, in fact, what it is in our world. There's a linear relationship between the degree to which the wire is extended and the value of the restoring force. Right? So we've got a qualitative law here, which is in the functional form that I gave you, standard notation that restoring force is equal to minus the value of the extension times some constant. And in my notation, what you got there towards the end of that long paragraph in F is that the functional relation between delta L and D, the position to produce a restoring force, is quantitatively whatever the value of that restoring force is on that particular wire. Right? So that's the law at hand. Okay, so that's W. Now, we want to address the dispositional essentialist view, that law is, at least on the uniform account, pure account of dispositional essentialism, that law ought to hold in every possible world. So let's go to another possible world. Right? In this other possible world, that fundamental constant K has a different value. Right? We all know in our world that different materials have different values of Young's constant. And of course, in our world, we think that this is a result of the composition of the wire. But remember, the wires are fundamental objects in the scenario I'm giving you. So you go to a different possible world, and it's a different fundamental constant in W star than it is in W. Now, one might argue that's enough to make it a different fundamental law in W star. Now, I don't want to lean too hard on this because, you know, there are issues here which for philosophy of science I think are interesting. Does a law that has the same mathematical form in one world as another, but different values of what we think of as fundamental constants, count as a different law? Yeah, one can go back and forth on this. That's a scenario, but I don't think it's completely persuasive. So let's go to a third world, W double star, right? In which, and here's the important point, the fundamental law of the relation between sanctions on wise and restoring forces is not linear, but it's quadratic, right? So when you've got an extension of the wire by delta x, the restoring force is proportional to the square of that extension and not just the linear relation of the extension itself. Have we got a different law? I think it's very hard to argue that you haven't. But, you know, we're dealing, and excuse me, with metaphysicians who have very creative imaginations, so let's suppose that they say, no, look, I mean, the linear and the quadratic form are just versions of a polynomial law, so you've actually got, you know, the same law. Okay, fine, right? But let's just take a much more exotic mathematical form, right, that is not polynomial, and then you just push that kind of persistent guy to the position where they say that all mathematical forms are fundamentally the same. And that strikes me as being indefensible. Right? Mathematicians have wasted their lives developing intricate categorizations for different mathematical functions and falling into different classes. If you go there, well, good luck, but I think that is genuinely not a good place to be. All right. So what we've got, I hope, with W star, or maybe W star 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 star, is a world in which you've got the same fundamental objects, wires, extensions, forces. They're the same properties because you can identify them without appealing to the dispositions and the manifestations. Same fundamental properties, different quantitative relations between them. Therefore, a different quantitative law. And that, I think, at least to me, is a conclusive reason to show that dispositional essentialism is not uniformly true. So, at best, you're going to get a mixed account of dispositional essentialism, which, of course, some people have argued for. How many of the laws, fundamental laws, are going to be not amenable to an essentialist view? I think probably the majority of them, because in the fundamental, generically physical sciences, most fundamental laws take on the quantitative form. And so if this argument is generalizable, as I think it is, you leave behind the simple toy example of Hooke's law and go to real examples, then I think you've got a pretty general argument that you cannot defend disposition essentialism for those laws. But undoubtedly, well, maybe not undoubtedly, that's a hard word to use. In some cases, and here Coulomb's law may well be an example, right? So we had the case where in the qualitative case, the fact that like charges repel one another may well be metaphysically necessary. It might be that Coulomb's law, right? The idea that, you know, the force between two like charges is proportional to the product of the value of the charges and inversely proportional to the distance between them. There are reasons, you know, in terms of the symmetry of spherical fields, to think that it's got to have that form given the spherical symmetry of the field that's involved. And that's, as you know, why a lot of inverse square laws have the form that they do. But you've got to commit yourself to the idea that in other possible worlds, charges always give you spherically symmetric fields, at least in the absence of other inhibitors. Maybe, but I think you have to have a pretty solid commitment to the idea that symmetry considerations in other possible worlds are the same as they are in our worlds, or that simplicity considerations, you know, give you spherical symmetry as opposed to something more complicated. I understand people find simplicity appealing. As a guide to the world, no. Okay, thanks. So I'm pretty close to finishing. All right. So let me finish up here. We've got an argument now that across possible worlds, laws converge. What about the within world case of the diachronic situation? All right. What do we do? Well, go back to the Hooke's law case. Okay. You remember, I hope, that Hooke's law itself, you know, simple linear relationship, is a pretty good approximation to what actually goes on in wires, but it's a pretty good approximation only within certain limits of extension of the wire. If you hang a massively heavy weight on the wire, the thing is going to lose its characteristic properties, and first of all, the law will become nonlinear, and then it will kind of collapse completely, and it won't provide any restoring force at all. What do we get from that? That the domain of application of something like Hooke's law, and remember that in world W, Hooke's law is fundamental, okay? The domain of application is limited to certain intervals of extension and thereby restoring forces. Outside that, Hooke's law does not hold. So we are prepared to allow that laws can have restricted domains of application. If you're willing to do that, then why not allow that laws could have restricted temporal domains of application? Now, you know, of course, in the older literature on laws, there's this prohibition against specifying particular times and places. And I understand that. But if you impose that, of course, you just blocked the idea that a law might not be universal when you quantify over all possible times of application. But if you believe that laws can be restricted in their applications, and most laws, not all, but most laws actually have those constraints on them. And they're not ceteris paribus conditions, they're explicitly stateable constraints. I think one shouldn't be imposing restrictions that the temporal application of the law can't be imposed. All right, so that's my answer to the general question of whether laws can change over time. I hope you can see that if you have a dispositional version of transformation emergence, then it immediately follows that transformation emergence can in fact have as an open possibility that the laws of nature can change. Now, one final thing and I'll finish. If you read the abstract, you'll see that I raised a number of questions. I've only answered one of them here, and that is, you know, whether the laws of nature can change. I think that the answer to all of them except the last one, which is at the moment not very clear to me, the answers to the other ones flow from the answer I've just given you to the question of whether laws can change. And I won't give you all those details here, but if you're interested during the Q&A, I'd be glad to do that. All right, so thanks for listening, and I'll be glad to answer questions.